Because, I mean, memoirs are just inherently personal. And I never thought that my life was worthy of a book. You know, you have to be somewhat delusional to even, you know, believe you can or set out to write a memoir.
What's good? I'm Nikisha Elise Williams, and this is Black and Published, bringing you the journeys of writers, poets, playwrights, and storytellers of all kinds. Today's guest is Dawn Turner, the author of Three Girls from Bronzeville, a uniquely American memoir of race, fate, and sisterhood. In recounting her own coming-of-age story with that of her sister and childhood best friend, Dawn set out to find the truth her writing told her about herself.
I didn't want this to be a story about one girl who did everything perfectly and the other girls, the other two who didn't, because that would have been bullshit.
An award-winning author and journalist, Dawn built her career at the Chicago Tribune and has reported from around the world. She explains how her global dreams started with her parents pointing her towards the sun. Plus, the secret she kept in shame until writing this book made her relive the vulnerable moments. And why, despite the stories of abortion, addiction, murder, and incarceration, Dawn says this story is one of redemption. That and more when Black and Published continues. Dawn, when did you know that you were a writer?
Oh, I think I will answer the way I've heard other people answer, and that is that I am still becoming a writer. I knew I wanted to write at a very early age because my sister and I would sit under the dining room table and listen to my mother, my aunt, and my grandmother, and sometimes other people. We would eavesdrop on their conversations. And I mean, they had this wonderful ability to tell stories. You saw the characters, you understood the themes. It just came so naturally to them. So I knew I wanted to do what they were doing and that I was telling stories.
And you capture that so beautifully in your memoir, talking about how they would be talking and you'd be under the dining room table listening. You have one of those opening scenes in your memoir. And they all had such a rich way of storytelling just from what you relayed on the page, which definitely comes across in your mother's voice, which, you know, I am obsessed with.
I am too, actually.
But in capturing those stories in your memoir, when was the first time that you tried to capture that same storytelling that you heard from your mother and grandmother and aunts and stuff?
Oh, my goodness. When I was in elementary school, my fourth grade teacher, I think it was, he had us write these stories. And he reminded me years later that I had written this elaborate story for him. And that was, I think, my first attempt to really to write something down that was in some way reminiscent of what I had heard with the women. And I think it was just about this. It was a story about these girls who get on this elevator, and it was coming off of what my best friend and my sister and I would do. We'd get on the elevator and would rocket up to the top of the building because we lived in a 24-story tower. And so that was the kind of the nature of my first story that I had written for my teacher. And he actually sent it in to Ebony Junior magazine, which is really cool. It wasn't accepted, but he saw some promise in it, and that was fantastic.
My mom used to always try to get me to send stuff in to Ebony because I believe they used to have the contest in John H. Johnson's name, and I think her name was Eunice.
Oh, his wife's name.
Yes. Yeah, they used to always have a contest in her name for young writers. And I don't know if I ever sent anything in or I just wasn't selected, but I do remember that being a thing, try to send stuff into Ebony. So in doing that and trying to send the story in but not being accepted, you ended up going to school for journalism, right?
Yes. Well, I didn't go for journalism. Initially, I wanted to be a doctor. But then along the way, that freshman year, I participated in a celebration commemorating the March on Washington. And I had been a part of the African American newspaper there. They invited me to join, and I just said yes. And I wrote a story, and that was my first story that was published in the Griot newspaper. And that's when the writing bug really bit me, that I could interview people and I could talk to them about their lives, and I could, you know, potentially do this for a living.
What was it about interviewing people and talking to them about their lives and all of that that interested you the most to want to pursue it in newspapers of all things?
Yeah, this was the 80s. We were still, as Black folks, the jobs that would mean something akin to upward mobility was, you know, medicine, going into law, maybe engineering, you know, the sciences or something. But journalism was not something that I saw a lot of people who looked like me in. There were pioneering African-American journalists, absolutely, at that time, but it just had not resonated that I could be a writer, or at least I could work for a newspaper or maybe a television news station. And that would come later. That would come with hanging out at the School of Media at the University of Illinois at Urbana and really learning that it was a potential career, because to go home to my parents were divorced at the time, but to say to them that I wanted to be a writer, that was not going to, that was, they're like, okay, we're sending you to college so that you can leave. You can be a self-sufficient adult. And so to be a writer, that did not, you know, I mean, that did not go together. They were kind of non sequiturs. So, but if I came home, which I did, to say that I wanted to be a journalist, I wanted to, you know, work for a newspaper that would pay me, that was something that was a little bit more palatable than, oh, Mom, I want to be a writer. I've read James Baldwin and Toni Morrison. I want to be a writer. They'd be like, uh-oh, that takes time. You don't have a trust fund. You don't have that type of time. Yeah, get a job.
Yeah, exactly. It's all well and good, but get a job.
Right.
All right. And so then you started with an internship at the Sun-Times before becoming an editor at the Tribune. Do you remember your first big byline in the paper?
Yes. My first big byline was actually a perspective piece with my colleague and my dear friend, Darlene Galanton. And it was a story about, she and I were 10 years apart, and she had grown up in the South and I'd grown up in Chicago. And we were talking about our different paths at State University. She had attended the University of Georgia. I was at the University of Illinois. And we were just talking about our different experiences. So we both had bylines on that story. And I just remembered it was a great experience. You know, it's always, I think it was Dr. King who said that seeing your name in the newspaper or in print was the vitamin A to the ego. And it is very much that, you know, I mean, you see your name there and you're like, okay, this is pretty cool.
Today it's on the internet and you just have to be okay with it.
That's exactly right. Yes.
So was it after that byline that then you began trying to write? Because you have two novels before this memoir, correct?
That's correct. Yes.
And in all of the working and the writing and living your life, the story that ends up playing out in Three Girls from Bronzeville is happening in real time. Were you always taking notes on what was happening around you for an idea of the memoir, or did that not happen until way later?
Well, I never thought that my life was worthy of a book. You know, we all have ups and downs and we just live our lives. And it, in the middle of it, I just couldn't see it being a book. There were just so many different things that I had to do. And I was trying to help my sister. I was trying to help my childhood best friend and more from afar with her. But throughout, I kept a journal. When we were children, we had diaries. And so I didn't really think of our story as being a story until 2010, when the other Wes Moore was published. Wes Moore just recently became the Democratic nominee for governor in Maryland. But his story was so moving to me. It was a story of these two young men who had the same name, Wes Moore, but they had dramatically different fates. And initially, when I started to think of our story, I only thought about Deborah and me. Mm. And so kind of playing on Wes Moore, I thought, well, maybe this is a story about two girls. I got an agent and she started to read various iterations of the proposal. And she said, Dawn, this isn't a story about two girls. It's a story about three girls. Because my sister, true to form, left off the page. And so I'm so happy that that agent said to me, it is a story about three girls. And then she said, it's a story about place. This historic neighborhood. And it's a story about your mother or your aunt and your grandmother. So, I mean, there are so many layers there. So, I mean, but your question about the some of the research came from documents that I had as a child that I kept. And then a lot of it came from interviews and then documents that would come later.
Hmm. And so your interest was piqued in 2010 with the other Wes Moore. I know there was an article that you did for the Tribune for your perspective piece, correct?
Yes.
That also added another layer to it. Was at that the time where you began to get deep into the research of, okay, I'm writing this book about my life, my best friend and my sister?
The first perspective piece on Deborah was published in 2000. And then I did a follow-up piece on her in 2002, and then another piece on her in 2007. So the first piece was her about her going to trial and having been convicted of murder. And then the 2007 piece that I did on her was about her graduating from college with honors while in prison. And I just thought that those were stories about Deborah and me. But I wanted to tell her story because I thought that her story had weight and it had meaning. So at that time, I didn't think that our story was a book. So early on, it was just me writing about this young woman I had known since we were girls. And I never wrote about Kim, my sister, in the pages of the Tribune. But I was just so fascinated about Deborah and trying to understand what her story meant in terms of her life trajectory, but also what did it tell me about me? Because there is an element, whether you're religious or not, but that I felt was there, but for the grace of God go I. And I didn't know, you know, and then there were people who said to me, oh, you would never have, you know, that would never have befallen you. And I'm like, you know, BS, because Black lives are so fragile that there is a degree of arrogance if you think that just because you do things, you try super hard to do things right, that you're going to land where you intended. Nothing is promised to anybody, no matter your race or socioeconomic status. But I think particularly with Black folks, we are particularly vulnerable.
And so knowing that about the vulnerability that you were living that was entwined in the lives of yourself, your sister Kim, and your best friend Deborah, and being told by your agent that there were three girls in the story and it was about place, what was the process of you working with your agent to bring it to publication?
So this started in 2010. And I was working full time at the Tribune at the time. And so I went through, it took me a while to put together the proposal, the book proposal, because that's how we wind up selling it years later. But the story, it took me a while to find the story for the proposal. And so that took a couple of years and then maybe a couple more years. And finally, the agent at the time said, we've gone as far as we can go with this. And I wish you well. And I hope to see this book on the bookshelves one day. So what I realized is that I hadn't quite found the story, but it was also the moment, you know, we hadn't yet had the police involved shootings. And even though that's not a part of the book, it was a story of, you know, the me finding the story, but also the book meeting the moment. Mm. And so when I did get the agent who wound up selling the book, the proposal was different and it was tighter and it was stronger. And I had changed. I had become a better writer and a deeper thinker and all of those elements that are needed for writing. But, you know, again, it sold. I mean, I think he sent it out on a Friday and I think it sold by Monday. Yeah, it was, I mean, it was super, it was, we were getting calls by Monday. So it was.
What year was this?
This was in 2018.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. But that is that. So the story there is about persevering. Mm. You know, it's about working hard because writing is a craft. We may be born with a degree of talent, but talent is not enough. So it is working your butt off to figure out the story. And the story, again, it's a complicated story on so many levels because I mean, memoirs are just inherently personal and you have to be somewhat delusional to go into it thinking, oh, at least maybe it's just me because I thought, well, I write for a living. I'll just tell the story. I'll tell it chronologically. And, you know, but then it's all the stuff you know you're going to tell, but then it's the stuff that you don't know that you're going to tell, that you feel like, I mean, and I didn't want this to be a story about one girl who did everything perfectly and the other girls, the other two who didn't, because that would have been bullshit. And so I had to share some things that I'd never told anybody because I didn't want to tell all of Deborah's and Kim's business without telling mine. But, you know, the things that we are ashamed of, the things that we think people will think differently about us, those are the things that when it, you know, we think that there is this like process where, you know, we're going to shrink if that information hits the air. There will be some decay or rot. But the reality is I want it to be open and honest and just tell as much truth as I could.
So you brought us all the way to where we got to start talking about the book. So I'm going to let you do a reading from whichever section you choose. Because you have all these allusions to what's in the book. And now I got to get ready to ask.
Black and Published family, it's time for the reading. Dawn Turner's memoir, Three Girls from Bronzeville, follows Dawn, her sister Kim, and her best friend, Deborah Trice, from their childhood living in a high-rise overlooking the projects on the South Side to their wildly divergent paths that imbued them with life while forcing them to accept death, all the while never forgetting the power of friendship, forgiveness, and second chances. Here's Dawn.
Okay. It'll just be from the very first chapter. It's called Our Ledge. I often think about my sister and my best friend, not every minute, not every second, every day. I mostly think of them when I am experiencing something that I would have wanted to share, some moment that would allow us to tug on a line, thin as a filament that begins, remember when, and draws a seemingly ever-present past nearer. When I imagine us, we come into focus at our beginning. Three young girls walking through our neighborhood under a prickly summer sun. I am 9 years old, tall and lanky, with long ropey braids. Deborah, my best friend, is shorter than me, and at 8 and a half is already prom queen pretty. And then there's my sister, Kim, who's 3 years my junior. She's stealthily trailing us, even though I've bribed her with our mother's secret stash of lemon drops to stay away. Mom is watching us from our 11th floor apartment window. She has told us to go outside and play. You two are the nosiest children God ever gave breath to, she always says. Get out from under grown folks' business. Later, she will ask me why I didn't hold Kim's hand, why I allowed her to hang so far behind. But right now, Deborah and I are walking through our apartment complex on our way to our special place. We are thing finders, two Black girls who have little in common with the popular children's book character Pippi Longstocking, an orphaned white girl with red hair and freckles. But we admire the way she spends her day collecting cast-offs for her thing finders club.
Okay, so you introduce us to your best friend and your sister when you're all very young, walking through the streets of Bronzeville and just being children. And you take us through, I think, from my understanding of being of Chicago and in the place that I grew up, for Bronzeville kind of on the edge of its heyday from like the 40s through the 60s and stuff, through the crack epidemic in the 80s and the deterioration in the 90s up to the gentrification that's been seen now in the neighborhood. So it's a wide span of time. Mm-hmm. Why was this place so integral to the story of yourself, your best friend, and your sister?
Right. Well, my great-grandparents arrived in Chicago from Mississippi in 1916. My grandmother was 3 years old. And for me, that's where the story starts, because my grandmother would tell all of these stories about coming to the city, fleeing the ravages of the Jim Crow South, and believing Chicago was the promised land. And then they would get here, and because of the influx of new migrants, just the sheer numbers, the city decided to confine the new Black residents to an area of town on the south side called the Black Belt. And as that Black Belt began to, it was a narrow strip of land initially, but that Black Belt began to expand eastward toward the lake. And in about another decade or two, that area became known, affectionately known as Bronzeville. And you had all of these people who had lived there, from the famed Ida B. Wells, the journalist and anti-lynching activist, and Gwendolyn Brooks, the amazing poet and writer at whose altar I still bow, Richard Wright. I mean, all of these amazing people. And so you had, as my grandmother would say, that they took a bunch of scraps and stitched together a world. And so when we were Deborah, Kim, and I were coming of age there in the 1970s, a half century after my great grandparents arrived there, the community had changed quite a bit. We were growing up in this brand new, beautiful apartment complex called the Theodore K. Lawless Gardens Apartments, named after a famous Black dermatologist. And the famous Black publisher, John H. Johnson, was one of the principal developers. And so by the time we were coming up there in Lawless Gardens, which, as my mother said, had an unfortunate name, but it was absolutely beautiful. The lawns were manicured, the janitors chased down garbage with a religious fervor, everything bright and shiny. Now, we were not at all wealthy. This was affordable housing that conferred a degree of dignity because it was so well maintained. But right across the street was a public housing complex named the Ida B. Wells Homes, so with this distinguished name. But the city had begun the process of abandoning it. And so there was decay and loss of opportunity that would just continue to spiral downward. And so we got the chance to see at, you know, from like a bird's eye view, these two places. And so that place, it was so important. I mean, the book is about people, but it is also about growing up in this place where for us, the expectations were high. I mean, we were, my sister, my best friend, and I, we were pointed toward the sun. We were the first generation of Black kids to come of age after the Civil Rights Movement. And our parents saw us as becoming homeowners. We were going to go to college and we were going to partake of every aspect of the American dream. And when that was not available for Deborah and Kim, I mean, the two loves of my life, I set out to understand why.
And you mentioned this earlier that in your quest to understand why and to really find the story, you had to do that type of digging and excavating that allowed you to explore the shame and the vulnerability and the reality of all of the different situations that you all found yourselves in, and that no one was perfect. Everyone had a flaw or a secret or something they would rather not share. In surfacing those themes of addiction, of abortion, and of, you know, just coming of age in a time where you have choices, and while you may have chosen one way, your friends and your friend and your sister chose differently. What did that bring up for you in reliving those moments?
As I said earlier, you have to be somewhat delusional to even, you know, believe you can or set out to write a memoir. Because what we typically do as humans, all of our tragedies, all of our challenges, we kind of pack them up, put them in the this kind of trunk of life, and we push it to the back of the closet. And I'm really good at compartmentalizing in that way. And so for a memoir, you have to go back into that closet and open that trunk and, you know, rifle through that stuff. And I just really never, I didn't understand how difficult that would be to relive my sister's struggle with alcoholism, why she turned to alcoholism, and then her passing. To go through court documents, hundreds and hundreds of pages of court documents, because I wanted to make sure that Deborah's story was right. Memory is so fallible, but to go through that and then to get some of those details about her life and her struggles with crack and how she landed on that square the night when she shot a man to death. To go back and relive all of that stuff was difficult. It was it was necessary, of course, because I wanted to write the book, and I'm happy that I did it, because I don't have to feel like I have to rifle through it anymore.
And you also mentioned how this was very much a connection to community, especially after the shooting deaths of so many young unarmed Black men and boys, and women too. We won't forget the women.
Yes, women too.
In realizing that there are some things that we don't discuss in our community, and the kind of climate that we're living in now politically, I'd be remiss not to surface. There are two instances that you talk about. Right before your sister is born, and your mother finding out that she's pregnant, and you talk about her having you play a game of jump on mommy's stomach. And then also of you deciding to have an abortion 2 weeks after you were married, and what those decisions means. But also that's juxtaposed to your sister Kim, who got pregnant young and ended up losing her child, which kind of surfaces the Black maternal health crisis and how that may have altered her trajectory in life because she grieved so heavily.
Right. I really do think that that having lost the baby, and the baby came too soon, was born too soon, that did devastate her. And it was a loss that she struggled to get over, but couldn't. Or maybe even she thought she could get over it. And I'm not certain that is something you ever really get over. But you can go forward. It's difficult. And so it was something that she struggled mightily with. And she self-medicated. And in that regard, it was with alcohol. And so, yeah, it was so important for me to tell that story about her losing the baby, because it did change her life. And it was important for me to tell the story about my own abortion because I was acutely aware. Since we were very young, my mother told us how, you know, the having pregnancies when we were very young, how that would change, you know, just completely recontour our lives. I was 24. I believe I conceived on the night that he proposed and we celebrated. But then I was devastated when I learned I was pregnant and I was not ready. And so I exercised my choice.
In talking about what your mom said to you, there are two quotes that I wrote down, one from page 71, where you write, "She told us that babies would nail our feet to the ground. They would reconfigure not only our bodies, but our goals and ambitions too." And then you have another quote on page 156, where you write, "When you have kids, even with the most helpful husband, you will care more about that child being whole than you." And I was like, first of all, nobody asked you. Nobody asked you for this wisdom. However,
is it true though, or is it true?
It's true. However, I love the honesty of that, and how that shaped your outlook and your choices, your mother's outlook and what she wanted for you. You talked about being, you know, that first generation that was pointed toward the sun to have all of these dreams and goals and ideas and ambitions. And even still, in reading the story of the three of you and of your parents as well, it still seemed like a game of chance.
Oh, yeah.
Do you feel like, and I know there's studies that have come out that said, you know, even in the most, for a Black child to grow up with like an affluent Black family in the same neighborhood as a white family of the same socioeconomic status, it's still like maybe a 50% chance for them not to fall back into poverty. Do you see that, you know, that statistic reflected in your own upbringing?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's some people might look at Deborah's and Kim's and my story and see, you know, well, one out of three. But I see it as two out of three who were able to make it. I mean, Deborah had a huge, huge stumble, a massive stumble. But her life now, she's been able to recover in a way that is incredibly remarkable. I admire her so much because she used her incarceration as a time to rehabilitate herself. But in terms of what my mother said, I mean, I always, you know, I was not the perfect kid, but I did listen because for me, rules were scaffolding, you know? I liked rules because I wanted to know where the boundaries were. For my sister and for Deborah, they were a little different. You know, rules were things that they pushed against. And so when my mother talked about early pregnancy, I mean, I listened to that. I mean, my future meant something to me. My teachers told me from a very young age that I should go to college. I had incredible test scores. I had great grades. But for Deborah and Kim, what the teachers focused on were their behavior. And so I saw myself through a different lens. And so, and I had my future laid out for me that, you know, I knew my goals, I knew what I wanted to achieve. And it's not like, you know, again, not all perfect, but I had a blueprint. And anything that would knock me off of that blueprint was something that I couldn't abide. And when we were ready, oh my God, we were all in. But at that moment, I was just starting my career, my marriage. We were married very young, and I just didn't think it was prudent to, you know, to have a child at that moment.
And in all of that, it comes back. It begins with and ends with Bronzeville and Chicago. And you write in the beginning on page 4, "For generations, Bronzeville has been a place where all that was good and bad is simultaneously at your fingertips, yet a walled-off world away." And then at the end of the book on page 314, you write, "Then the world would look at what ails Chicago and pretend to wonder how it happened and how to fix it. What do you say to people living on Chicago's South Side and in Bronzeville now about the legacy they're carrying on, either directly or indirectly, whether they know it or not?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing that I would say is that we often paint the South Side of Chicago with an incredibly broad brush. My friend Lee Bay, who was an architecture critic here in Chicago, talked about the South Side being the size of, and I think I'm getting this right, maybe Philadelphia? But it's a huge area. And so there are different neighborhoods. There are different communities. Some communities are well-resourced and some are not. And so when we talk about this, we're talking about those communities that are beleaguered, that are challenged. And so, but there is this legacy that is not just about, you know, people not doing what they need to do to keep the neighborhood clean or safe. It goes back, there are these roots that go back decades, housing policies, from redlining policies, from these contract leasing policies. And it's from housing covenants, you know? So this is not a question about, well, what is the problem? It's a question of will we fix it? And a commitment to fixing it. Whenever we have something massive that affects other neighborhoods, we figure out how to fix it. And so it's, you know, will we put the money toward it and not just get in there and, you know, hang out for a couple of years? These problems go back generations. So we've got problems that we have to fix that we may not see, you know, the fruits of the labor for a while, but we have to keep doing it.
And with that said, what do you want your readers to get from your memoir?
It's a story of redemption and forgiveness and second chances. It's a story of friendship and sisterhood. And I think my mother is incredibly funny. And so it's not just gloom and doom. It is our story coming of age, in which we three girls start out in virtually the same place and wind up taking spectacularly different avenues. But it's that journey that I think is the story.
All right. So now I want to shift to a speed round in my game before I let you go for the afternoon. Okay. What is your favorite book?
Oh my God, I have so many favorite. I'm looking at my desk right now, but I think that my favorite book is a book that's called Blacks by Gwendolyn Brooks.
Who is your favorite author?
Gwendolyn Brooks.
I should have saw that one coming. What is your favorite TV show?
I'm loving Succession.
I still haven't watched it yet.
Oh, it's so good. It's so smart. It's just one of those things where you're hooked on it. Yeah.
I'll have to give it a binge. So we've got a plethora of Chicago shows on TV now. You got The Chi and 63rd Street, the whole Dick Wolf series on NBC. Mm-hmm. So if Three Girls from Bronzeville got the TV show or movie treatment, who should play the three girls from Bronzeville?
Oh my goodness. I have, because as you said earlier, the story covers so many decades. You'd have to have, I would think, several actors playing, you know, the girls at different ages.
You'd have to have like the This Is Us treatment for the three girls because of the time periods that it spans.
Yes, yes. And I love, that's another one of the shows. I love them. My daughter will say sometimes that I'm like Beth, and I that's such a huge compliment. But I love me some Randall. Huge crush.
What do you think is the best book to movie adaptation or book to TV show adaptation?
Oh, without question, To Kill a Mockingbird. And it's not even my all-time favorite book. I love the book, but that one comes to mind.
And as a longtime Chicagoan, if money were no option, where would you go, what would you do, and where would you live?
One of my favorite places in the world, I love the Bahamas. I used to spend the beginning of the year there. And so I absolutely love it. It's one of my favorite places in the world. I've traveled broadly and I love it.
And then I almost forgot, as a Chicagoan, are we eating deep dish or tavern style pizza?
I no longer eat pizza.
Wait, what?
I know. I'm sorry. I don't eat a whole lot of pizza, but it would be a thin crust. I don't like deep dish.
That just hurt my whole heart because all sorry. I want when I go home is Italian fiesta. All I want.
I'm sorry.
Like, there was a whole write-up on, like, the Chicago-style hot dog in the New York Times, like, 2 days ago.
Oh, well, yeah, and I don't eat hot dogs at all.
Okay, we're just going to leave that alone.
I'm sorry.
We're going to go. It's fine. It's fine. We're going to go to rewriting the classics. What's the one book you wished you would have written?
I love How the Word Was Passed. It's Passed by Clint Black. And I think that that's beautiful. I also, so you want one book. I love South to America by Imani Perry.
I have that. I haven't read it yet, though.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I love Cast by Isabel Wilkerson. Mm-hmm. Oh, I also love, if you haven't read, Tyra Miles's All That She Carried. Mm-hmm. Absolutely gorgeous. It won the National Book Award last year.
My to-be-read list is already a shambles.
No, I get it. Because of this podcast,
but yeah. I just keep adding more books.
I know. And actually, I think her name is Taya. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then name one book where you would want to change the ending and how would you do it?
Maybe Leave the World Behind by Rumen Alam, because I really did love the book, but the ending felt like there was some question, too many questions that weren't answered for me.
Got it. And then my little messy question, name a book that you think is overrated or overtaught and why?
Oh, a lot of the classics. because I think that there's so many books that we're told that, you know, or we were told in high school, and I hope this isn't the case now, that we had to read. And there are these stories about people who, you know, I mean, written by old white men. Ernest Hemingway, and I'm certain he was, you know, his work was profound at a time, and I'm not, you know, throwing a whole lot of shade, but I'm just not there. Anything by Ernest Hemingway. Sorry.
No, it's fine. It's fine. And so my final question before we go for the afternoon, when you are dead and gone and among the ancestors, what would you like someone to write about you and the legacy of words and work that you left behind in both your books and what you did at the Tribune?
That it was really important to me to be a good person. And in being a good person, I hope that I was able to be a good writer and to tell stories that that are often dismissed and ignored. And that made people, you know, think about something that they thought they knew differently. That's really, I mean, that is, I don't want to be the type of writer who just writes pretty words. Mm. I want those words to be impactful. And that's what I hope people will say.
Thank you, Dawn.
Thank you so much, Nakisha.
Big thank you to Dawn Turner for being here today on Black and Published. Make sure you check out Dawn's memoir, Three Girls from Bronzeville, out now in paperback from Simon & Schuster. And if you're not following Dawn, follow her on the socials. She's at Dawn Turner Trice on Twitter and Writer Dawn Turner on Instagram. That's our show for the week. If you like this episode and want more Black and Published, head to our Instagram page. It's at Black and Published, and that's BLK and Published. There, I've posted a bonus clip from my interview with Dawn about how she got into writing as a hobby while riding mass transit. Make sure you check it out and let me know what you think in the comments. Next week on Black and Published, our guest will be Katrina Canyon, author of the poetry collection Surviving Home.
I go to the emergency room at New York Presbyterian, and when I get there, I said, yeah, my therapist said that I'm here to get assessed for medication. And the woman said, okay, hold on. And a police officer comes out and says, follow me. And at the point I said, oh crap, I'm getting ready to get locked up.
That's next week on Black and Published. I'll holler at y'all later. Peace.